Welcome to Radio Evolve. Welcome, Marc Vernon. Very happy that you're here.
Yeah, good to join you. Thanks for inviting me on.
Yeah, great you are here, Marc. You are a psychotherapist and author. You wrote about Dante's work and also Owen Barfield's work and the mysticism of Christianity. And your latest book is about William Blake and his work on, or his thinking and working with imagination. And maybe I want to start with that question. What is intriguing you in that topic of imagination and how William Blake thought and also, you know, expressed the power of imagination in his art, in his work?
Yeah, well, thank you. It's a very central question, of course. I think it intrigues me because imagination is presumed by many, I would imagine, if not most, to be a good thing, and that it's expansive, it is part of creativity, also exploration, inquiry. It's a capacity that would be thought essential to any kind of expansion of the soul or the mind or human awareness. And yet, there's a strange thing about the way that the imagination has been talked about in the last couple of centuries, and this is what Blake is onto, that it's seen as a kind of private faculty, as if you have imagination, I might have imagination, it generated from somewhere inside our bodies, perhaps, or our minds. It sits uncomfortably with this expansive view, then, because the question immediately arises, how do I know that my imagination isn't just my personal fantasies, or isn't deluded, or isn't even, if you follow what the scientists would tell you about imagination, it's actually just exists within the cave of your mind. And the way that perception might work, for example, as is often explained, is that there is a role for the imagination, but it's kind of like a hallucination, that the brain fills in lots of the gaps of our perception on the assumptions that it's already incorporated. And so whilst that is quite serviceable and useful day by day, the imagination in that view kind of traps us as much as anything else, because it's going on memory rather than a more expansive view of the imagination, which would actually be going on inspiration, that which is taken in more than that which is just being recycled inside the skull. And so I think there's this big tension going on with the notion of the imagination, even as, you know, most people presumably would say, you know, we believe in the imagination. And Blake was onto this. And Blake lived in the age where this enclosed view of the imagination was really starting to take hold. In the UK, it's associated with figures like John Locke and Adam Smith and others, who said that really our lives and our engagement with the world is via a stream of projections. We project out onto the world. We receive sense impressions, but not a living vitality, and we sort of jumble that around inside ourselves and try and make some sort of good enough worldview. 100 years or so later, with the advent of psychotherapy and Freud, imagination then is seen as our fantasies, much shaped by our psychopathology, by our neuroses, or even on occasion by our psychoses. I think that worldview needs to be challenged. And Blake certainly felt that it's not that you or I have something called imagination and fantasy, but rather that the imagination has us, that everything that lives and dwells in the world, in the cosmos, its very manifestation in all its diversity and activity and form, is an expression of what Blake called the divine imagination. It's all held within the imagination of God. And whether or not you want to go the whole theistic way, I certainly think that the imagination is private to a sense that we participate or co-create or collaborate. We receive from a much wider imagination. That's really fundamental. And to me, it immediately makes sense. And one of the reasons why it makes sense is you can, on occasion, if you work in mental health, meet people who are trapped in their private imagination, and they are unwell, they are suffering, their lives are caught in tight spirals, maybe of trauma. And so it seems to me that the official view from science of the imagination actually describes a very unwell state of affairs for a human individual. And so the scientific explanation, if you like, became just implausible to me because of working with people who are very unwell, have this privatized, trapped, fantastical life. It's called mental ill health. Part of the reason that Blake helped me was because he has another account of the imagination and our sharing it, that actually seems to me to be a vision of flourishing, which of course you also, day by day. I mean, we're talking now, we're having a conversation, and the way that a shared conversation works is by entering a field of language and feeling our way through that field so that we have a shared exchange that really is a participation in a kind of wider whole, a wider language, a wider imaginative presence that when we talk, we're just trying to navigate a path through. So I'm even now trying to find the right words will help us and our listeners, you know, through this great expanse, this universe of meaning and so on, that we access through the imagination that reaches to us as much as we reach out to it. Blake, who was a very smart thinker as well as someone we think of as a poet and a painter, sought to challenge this constraining view. And I think 200 years on since his death, which incidentally was in 1827, so 2027 is the bicentenary of his death. We really need this. You can give it a sort of philosophical account, but also just by reflecting on the way that imagination actually works leads us in that direction. It needs discernment. We can make mistakes, that. But if all we were doing was recycling our private sense of things, then life really would be bad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's really great how you're laying that out, and because it points to a real predicament that we are in our times and in our way of being. I mean, at least in the Western world, this highly individualized world that we are living in, it reminded me that in earlier times there were myths that could hold a whole culture. They were common. They were more, the individuals felt more embedded in that mythic way, like maybe in the Greek mythology or even in indigenous worldview. And we moved out of that into this individualized and rational perceiving and being with the world, which also has its, has its value. But it also seems we are now in a point stuck there, and how you was naming that everyone is kind of stuck with their own being, their own, interiority. And then is this kind of little bubbles of interiority trying to move along, but also often bump into each other because we cannot sense there is something that we are really deeper grounded. And I feel what you're pointing to is that there is a whole different view of seeing also, what emerges in us individually as thoughts, as feelings, but also more importantly as imagination and kind of images, also language holds meaning, actually something that we share in the first place, and from there can actually explore that unitive field of meaning together and also recognize when it shows up in someone. We are also doing now in a conversation, like you said, also in an artwork of Blake, where something comes that is not just, oh, he was a great, you know, he had some crazy ideas or interesting ideas, but there's actually showing something from reality or from how life and the universe is, shows up through that individual. But we can kind of also receive that bigger reality and interact with it. And I feel really a big shift how we see ourselves.
Yeah, that very much makes sense. But it's also to say that as well as being a view that connects us with reality once more, and so that's part of the test. Does this take us somewhere? Does this lead somewhere? Is this generative? You know, figures like Albert Einstein, who much valued the imagination, he said that he thought imagination is given to us precisely in order to make the world better. And so he's well often quoted in imagination circles, saying, you know, knowledge can focus on particular things, whereas imagination encompasses the world. And he's well celebrated for his great paradigm-shifting discoveries that came from imaginative undertakings. So special relativity that reflects so much on the nature of light, from thought experiments in which he imagined traveling on a beam of light, much like a child might travel on a train in their, you know, nursery. But the great test, I think, is does the product of an imaginative inspiration lead somewhere? Is it generated? Can it be taken up by other people? And the great art does this, of course, too. You know, Van Gogh's sunflowers change the world the way that everyone sees sunflowers. Or Blake, you know, phrases like "dear world in a grain of sand and a heaven in a wild flower." You may not know quite what that means, but you know, inviting you to appreciate more about life. So it has. That's one of the ways that I think is really, really important. And sometimes people are worried that, you know, how do they tell the difference between their private fantasy and something that's a received imaginative experience? And that's a very easy question to ask. You know, does it just rise or fall? Does it amuse you momentarily? Does it frighten you momentarily? Or is it something that you constantly recur to and that others do? And of course, language is like that. Language takes us to connection, to a wider sense of things, just to use language as an example again.
Yeah, and also there is also a sense in us human beings in some way for that deeper field of meaning. Like, that's also why great art has such a sustaining power, you know, to speak to us or to transmit something, where we see an artist is not just, you know, creating something out of his individual mood or maybe capacity, but the sense, oh, there is something where there is somehow a door opens into a deeper interiority of the world, or a deeper sense of, oh, there is something. It's not just it has a certain quality of meaning that is not just random or a kind of individual, you know, or something. I think also that is a sense that we don't really develop in our time to also listen to that resonances in us, where something really speaks deeply to us, and then move towards that and say, oh, what is this? And because it seems to me also imagination is not something we have, and it's also something to be engaged with. How do you see that? How to engage that imaginative capacity, or even maybe, if I don't know if develop is the right word, but to give that more space in our lives.
Yeah, you're making me think of how art is often displayed these days, which would be in an art gallery. And there's a great advantage to that. You know, if it's accessible, you can enjoy a rich display of works and so on and learn about them. Many galleries, anyway, not all, but many galleries are kind of extracted from a wider context. A work of art is in a frame and then it's on a wall, and the wall's designed to be, you know, relatively neutral for attention to the work of art, or if it's a sculpture, the room. And I think that can foster inadvertently privatized imagination. You know, that we're a kind of spectator looking onto something, and it's in its world, I'm in my world. It keeps us in our worlds, even if it feels like it's offering something. You know, it is consoling, or it is inspiring, or it's speaking in some. Whereas, you know, in the pre-modern world, what we would now call art, of course, was much associated, say, with worship or with ritual practices, and was in spaces like cathedrals, which are designed to open a whole worldview to you. And it seems to me that there's something lost in the modern art gallery. It actually colludes a bit with this narrower sense of the imagination. It's why, you know, to see a work of art, in inverted commas, in its original context, like to see, I don't know, a Renaissance image in the church still, behind the altar, within that whole context, is a very different experience, let me put it no more strongly than that, from seeing it removed and placed in a gallery. Don't get me wrong, I'm not against galleries. I go to them myself all the time, but it often strikes me, you know, what's really being fostered here. You know, I think another way in which this shows up in relation to galleries is that if you read the blurbs by the work of art, or if you read the catalogue, there'll be a lot about the production of the work, say, and about the provenance of the work, and about the history of the artist in relation to other artists and so on. But very often, there's very little about the meaning of the work. What actually is it trying to say to you? What's it opening up to you? It's like, we shouldn't really go there. That's a private matter for the viewer concerned. And I think that's a great loss, because you lose a wider context in terms of the discussion about the worldview that that work of art is showing. But that is, as it were, pressed upon you when you, say, step into a cathedral and see a statue, or see a painting, an icon.
Yeah, what you are pointing to seems to me also speaking to the participatory nature of that imaginative capacity, that it is not just a kind of just observer, happening as an observer and looking at something and making your own thoughts, but imagination is also very much, to me, it seems a really participatory process. You know, when you go into a church, that is clear, and you have an artwork. I mean, you can still try to be a neutral observer. Maybe that works. But there's also something you're stepping into. The participatory nature of the place is because you participate in the kind of higher presence that room is trying to manifest, or to make a connection with. And I feel also artists, and I guess also William Blake, artists like that, also are not just making images or poems to, you know, to kind of read and think, oh, it's beautiful or well done or something, but they wanna reach the reader or the viewer to also that something internally gets into movement, gets into process, and gets that there's really a conversation happening, even though, you know, the poet, the painter is not there anymore as a person. But there is a way to engage in that conversation, and I feel that is also connects me what you said in the beginning, the flourishing that is possible for imagination, the generative capacity, because that's something I feel where this deeper also creative energies in us human beings can activate when we look at an artwork or a poem or whatever it is like that, that it's not just, oh, this William Blake was such a genius and I don't know anything about this, but not saying, you know, he had a particular way of expression that was masterful. Still, the same capacities are also in us, and to communicate with that, what someone like Blake could express. How do you see that participatory process in imagination?
Yeah, participation is such a crucial word. Maybe just to expand on it in a more philosophical sense, sometimes contrasted with the more speculative stance. And so it relates to epistemology, how we know things. And again, in Blake's time and very much in ours, an objective stance is regarded as the one that conveys the most truth, whereas a subjective encounter with something is regarded as just personal, probably certainly skewed by your personal preferences, say, if not wholly fantastical. And this juxtaposition of the objective and the subjective has a history. And funnily enough, it was about in Blake's time, 200-300 years ago, that the objective started to become regarded as the standard for truth. It, of course, had much to do with the emergence of the scientific method and using what people like John Locke, Isaac Newton and others was called the empirical method. Best ground the truth of things by taking measurements, by observation. And you facilitate that process even more by removing assumptions. So you try and look at the empirical data objectively. That was reflected in language even. Before, in the medieval world, say, and in the ancient Greek world, objective meant just mere surface. And mere surface really wouldn't tell you anything very much about something, because mere surfaces change all the time. And if you wanted to know the truth of something by the medieval or the ancient stance, you needed to know the essence of it. What's it in itself? What's its soul? And this was called the subjective. And so the subjective meant finding the heart of things. So this was sort of flipped. The subjective was still regarded as important, but unreliable. And the objective became the gold standard. And this would have been very strange thought to the medieval ancient mind, because they had a participative sense of the world. You could only really know something by having a relationship with it, by receiving from it or giving to it, and who you were in terms of your qualities, your habits, your virtues, much mattered, therefore. So if you read Plato's philosophy, he's very preoccupied with the characters of the people that he encounters in his dialogues, and talks a lot about virtues, not just because that's seen as good, but because who you are much affects what you can know. The gold standard for knowledge has removed the qualities that the personality of the scientist, for example, have. And when I did my philosophy PhD, I didn't ask what kind of person is my supervisor. I wanted to know whether they understood the subject. These kind of flips are going on all the time. But again, you can challenge this notion that the objective is the gold standard. So, for example, I also did a physics degree at one point as an undergraduate. That was, you know, a little while ago now, maybe even 40 years ago. Physics back then was really quite different from physics now. The Big Bang was regarded as the standard story of the emergence of the cosmos. Now the Big Bang is just routinely challenged and questioned. That's where the science is. quantum theory, of course, was well developed, but there wasn't now the way that that's understood through things like string theory and M theory. Science changes very substantially, even over the course of a generation. This happened in biology. In the 1970s, Richard Dawkins published his book, The Selfish Gene, the neo-Darwinian account of biological evolution. That's all now very substantially challenged. Evolution is thought not just at the genetic level, but at all sorts of levels. And there's epigenetics, systemic biology, and even the sense there's a kind of intelligence in organisms, not just in their brains, but at all levels of the organism. This is now where the cutting edge science is. So science changes. And the reason for that is because it looks to the surfaces, it looks to the behavioral, it looks to the measurement and infers from there. But if you want to know about the truth of life, you know, you can still read a Platonic dialogue that was written 2,500 years ago, and it will tell you something. Or you can still read Shakespeare, you know, that's 500 years old, and you will still learn about love by reading that. And the subjective actually is that which speaks of more steady perceptions of reality. That we live with a number of delusions, I think. The objective is useful. The objective is useful when you can control the environment. And this is what happens when you make technology. You know, if you build a plane, everything in the plane is controlled. And that makes for a stable bit of technology that can make you do a rather unnatural thing, like fly. But for most of our lives, and certainly for when it that is more human, too many variables to control. And so we engage with things in different ways, like through, say, our imaginative encounters, or through thinking about qualities like virtues.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it also points to me to something that is related to the subject and the object, and maybe it's subjective, objective, and maybe it's just the same in a different wording, but it's also the interiority and the outer world. There is obviously our whole existence is somehow manifested in that way. We have an interiority, we have consciousness, we have thinking, feeling, and imagination, and different capacities in our interiority, and there is an outer world of objects and things, and you know, that we encounter, and it seems the same split has been made in a certain way. There is this outer world that we can manipulate, and you know, we can do what we want, basically. I mean, now we are discovering that doesn't quite work even on that level, because then, you know, our life sustaining basis can be threatened, like with climate change and things like that. But basically, there is an outer world that is just, you know, objects to move around like we want to. And there is an interiority that we, you know, that is private, and where we can do in a certain way also what we want, and kind of find our own, you know, maybe happiness or what we think is kind of for us desirable in life. But I think what you are pointing to, and what also Blake is pointing to, are also, you know, figures around the same time like Goethe or the early romantics in Germany or other throughout history, that there is also a way that our interiority and the outer world are more part of a whole existence that also speaks to each other, and not to say they are one or whatever. That could also, I think, you know, lead to misconceptions, but that there is a way that what we see in the outer world is also something that can find a representation or a kind of, meaningful resonance in our interiority, and that there is a way to also, you know, bridge the objective and the subjective in that way, to see, oh, it's part of a whole. And what we also, you know, when I see it, when I perceive a tree and say this is a tree, or when a poem expresses that, it's also not just a subjective representation, but it is also a communication with that tree in nature and a real dialogue, and how do you see that dichotomy with the inside and the outside in that way?
Yeah, I mean, I have engaged with Goethe through an English figure, Owen Barfield, who was great friends with C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien. Barfield was deeply influenced by Goethe through his engagement with Rudolf Steiner, who of course worked on Goethe as well. Both Barfield and Steiner much loved William Blake. And this is coming back to your question eventually, but really I think they loved Blake because they saw that in Blake there is a way of having this dialogue that you're talking about that is a real encounter with other spiritual beings or other living beings that have their own mode of imagination, their own mode of language, their own active presence in the world. And so Blake will say something like, the wise man sees not the same tree that the fool sees. And he'll say things like, when you see the sun rise, some will say you only see a golden disc about the size of a guinea popping up over the horizon, whereas I tell you, I see the company of the heavenly host crying, holy, holy, holy. That everything, and a phrase that Blake often uses actually as well is, all things are men seen afar. But what he meant that is not that all things are male human individuals. He says cloud, moor and star, sea, air and land, flower, creature and nymph. All are men seen afar, and by men he's drawing on the word this that has the root mens. He means intelligence, and it's intelligence not in the rational sense, but a kind of mode of actively, wisely, flourishingly participating in the cosmos. And so when Blake says all things are men seen afar, he means that all the beings, animate and indeed inanimate, you know, the rocks and so on too, they have their own way of being, is already in dialogue with the other things around them. And that we human beings seem to have this extra capacity to become conscious of that, you know, self-reflectively conscious of that. And Blake, I think, felt that that was very much part of our task to have this dialogue with other spiritual beings, all things seen as spiritual beings. And I think Steiner and Barfield felt that was part of their mission to help awaken people to that. Blake gives you a kind of foretaste of what that might be like through his art, through his poetry. You know, so he talks about wandering through London streets and feeling the active presence even of the pavement and even of the mantelpieces in the houses and even of the roofs of the buildings. Perceived with the imagination, which means sort of stepping over the surface appearance and becoming more conscious of all that maybe went into, if it's an artificial object like a pavement or a roof, all that is expressed in that architecture, in that design, the spirit of all these things can have a dialogue with it. It can speak to you and you can speak to it. And again, you know, this isn't so strange because we're very conscious now often how the environment much matters to us. And again, in the world of mental health, people will often be advised to go into different environments, to go into the natural world, say, or to be a very alert to a limited environment in which they're living, because that will have an effect upon them. And it's often described in more behavioral kind of way. But really what this is about is re-encountering the spirit in all things that's dialoguing with you already. So I think Blake is a wonderful person to read and to enjoy because that's why people are enticed by phrases like to see a world in a grain of sand and a heaven in a wildflower. They sort of know it's true and they want to know more how it's true. But if you reflect on how your environment already affects you and the impacts it has upon you, then you're already beginning to open up this imaginative dialogue with the world around you again. And so the tree, you know, is not just an object that stands in the way, but is a creature that will move some to tears, as Blake also says in another place.
Yeah, that's beautiful. And I think it reminds me, there is this phrase that Henri Corbin named. I don't know if you know Henri Corbin, who speaks about the mundus imaginalis, the imaginal, and to saying that, as I understand it, that our whole world, and I think that's what you also said in the beginning, what Blake was pointing to, that the whole world is an expression of imaginative capacity, because everything, like you also said now with, you know, going through a city, but everything that is around us is part of that creative process, and is, you know, even the trees, the animals, ourselves, but also the things that we created as human beings, and also created with a certain intention and with a certain, you know, yeah, consciousness also. I mean, also architecture and things like that, that we are basically living in a world that is where we are already embedded in, you could say, fields of meaning and of conversation, even though we often might not know it or only know it in certain cases, like you say, when you move into a forest, something is present here, a kind of openness to sense, saying, oh, what kind of trees they are and how much wood you can make out of them. I think that's also a view. But I think when you sense a little bit, or a sunrise or something like that, or a loved one, which a newborn child, I mean, for every person, there's moments where you feel like something is in reality and is speaking to me in a deeper way. And it, to me, it shows that what can be a way to show or to move into that the whole world is more in, you know, is inherent meaning that we can interact with. And it also feels to move in that direction very, very important in a time where there's also a lot of meaninglessness. People look for meaning and cannot really find it in many cases. And there's alienation and all of that. I think you must probably be best aware of the psychological, you know, effects of all of that. How do you think also in our time is there a way to reconnect with that wider sense of aliveness or meaning? How do you see that?
Well, is it, you're absolutely right. This sort of sense of alienation is part of our times. And I think that it partly comes from this worldview that consciousness is generated inside your skull, inside my skull, but there isn't a wider field of consciousness or field of imagination. And I think that that has a profoundly alienating impact upon people because they believe it. But strangely, also at the same time, you know, we live in a world that's sort of flooded with meaning. You know, you can't step out of your house without being assaulted by surfaces with screens advertising things at you. Or, of course, you know, we hold these devices in our hands that are constantly pushing promises of meaning or, you know, modes of entertainment. As well as the alienated side, part of the confusion is we have this wildly kind of incoherent, I don't know, surge of promises of meaning and purpose and insight and pleasure and so on that sort of flood us at the same time. And I think, again, that sort of melange of meaning, which is incoherent and doesn't take us anywhere, you know, to use the distinction that we were saying earlier between the imagination proper and the fantastical. We live in a rather fantastical world often, with little hits of meaning that don't add up, that don't cohere, that don't take us somewhere, that don't reconnect us with the wider world, that aren't expansive and so on, that don't call to our humanity, but instead pander, you know, to our consumptive and Blake himself, he said, more is the cry of a mistaken soul. If you get on that kind of hedonic treadmill of just wanting more and more, that's going to undermine your soul. But he said, less than all cannot satisfy man. We're pulled to the infinite, even though we're finite. We're pulled to the eternal, even though we're temporal and so on. And I think, therefore, that there's something about our times, as well as this story of a private individual, there's also the way in which everything is just kind of a flood of incoherent meanings. And so, again, Blake and others have addressed that. You know, this is why Blake is very strikingly, say, a Christian mystic. He has a porous, open Christianity, not a narrow, dogmatic. But the point about the Christian element for him, it is a way that all these things can be brought together and can add up. So for him, the imagination is the divine imagination, you know, much as figures like Coleridge and so on said. And so I think that that broader philosophical or even theological element really matters. The meaning crisis, if you like, is as much a product of a flood of meanings that we're not quite sure what to do with as it is meaninglessness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's important, because I think what you're talking to is that we are also confronted with so many surfaces. I mean, so many surface appearances, like on smartphones or, you know, social media. I mean, we are kind of bombarded with kind of bits of information, or maybe not even information, but just agitation, to get our attention caught into that. But it is not communicating a kind of meaningful entry into the coherent understanding of the world. It's just meant to get us agitated and just busy with looking at things. I think it's very important to also point that we live in a world where we're confronted with so much input and information, and now with artificial intelligence, there's another way to create things. And I think also in that context, rediscovery and enlivening of that creative capacities in our humanness is particularly important. Or how do you see that?
Yeah, I mean, this is the humanities matter as much as science, technology, and those subjects. They matter too, and in fact, you know, properly taught are deeply imaginative undertakings. As I said, I did a physics undergraduate degree. My tutor is quite a well-known cosmologist, and he's talked about how physics for him is an imaginative connection with the divine imagination. He thinks mathematics and physics and so on is just a kind of way into the wider intelligence that runs throughout the whole cosmos. In a way, anything that leads to an expansion of your worldview, particularly that expansion engaged not by an accumulation of experiences. It's not about having a bucket list of the 100 things you want to do before you die. It's expansive in the sense that it opens up more and more of the vitality that's inside all things, which you feel inside you as well, so that you know yourself not to be alone, but to be part of this wider dynamism. And it's why things like love matter. You know, when you fall in love with someone, it's because you fall in love with who they are as a living soul. You might fall in love with their physical beauty to start, but that doesn't last so long. But if you can fall in love with their physical beauty as an expression of their inner soul, then you've got a relationship on your hands. And I think similarly, you know, love as that which draws us out of ourselves and that which calls us through what's good, beautiful, and true. You know, these old insights, they're all there. They're just kind of waiting to be rediscovered. That's often when breakthroughs occur. And I don't think we should go back. This is not a nostalgic call. Figures like Blake and Dante, who you mentioned, I think they were very future orientated figures. But they knew that by where we've got to in the present, by past, that's the way that you find a new mode of life for the future. You know, that's part of what he inspired. You know, Blake doesn't just tell about how things were. He inspires you for how things could be. Yeah, so there's something about that orientation, I think, that really matters.
And can you say a bit more? You mentioned also again now and in the beginning that Blake and also you mentioned about that cosmologists speak about the divine imagination. Can you say a bit more how Blake was seeing that, speaking that there is a kind of divine aspect to imagination or to the world and its imaginative nature?
Yeah, he means, I mean, if you take a word like light, the word light can be used to describe physical light, you know, that means we're not in darkness, so we can see each other now and we're looking at each other from illuminated screen, you know, that project out the light that is described by, say, by Isaac Newton or by more recent physics. But light is also a word that we quite naturally use for feeling enlightened. You know, I hope that as people listening to us will feel, oh, yeah, that makes sense, you know, and there's a kind of light bulb moment even. And, you know, when you have a good conversation too, there's a sense of sharing the light and wanting to amplify the light through what you say. So light is quite naturally an inner sense as well. But if you give it the mystical or the theistic twist, there's also the source of all light, whether it be external light or interior light. And this is sometimes called the light of lights, or it's sometimes called the darkness that is light, because it's that which is implicit in the light that we see around us. I mean, I've actually got behind me this image here. This is a Blakean image, and maybe I can sort of show it on the screen. For those who are listening to us, it's Blake's image of Albion Rose, and it shows a youthful form dancing on rocks with hands outstretched. And behind the figure is this blaze of light, and it's in the rainbow colors of red and blue and yellow. And you can look at the picture and think, you know, is this a figure who is dancing in front of a kind of stellar burst? You know, the light, as it were, is coming from the sky behind him, which would be more like the physical light. Or is this figure, the burst of light is coming from within them, that their dance is itself an expression of a light that's coming from within? You know, we might say that they're aglow, they're shining, they're radiant from within them. And the answer is it's both. Blake paints the picture, so it's clearly both. But there's also the sense of the source of the light and the light radiating from one particular point in the picture, whether it's behind the figure, whether it's within the figure, you can't quite tell. And I think that's deliberate, because this source of all light is the center that's everywhere, and that is the divine light. And so I think when you reflect on these things and ask about the source that is sustaining and emanating, that's the sort of third step. There's not just the physical, there's not just the interior, but there's also the source. And that's why Blake, I think, talks about the divine imagination, that there is the imagination we're part of that is flowing through us, that's flowing through all things. But then there's the kind of divine imagination that holds and sustains, energizes that, the spirit, it might be called in another way, or God in another way. And so that kind of unity amidst all the diversity really mattered to Blake. It's part of this coherence of the worldview that we need, I think. So again, it kind of comes from reflecting with the mind's eye on what we observe, and so amplifies it, so gives it a sort of a point that helps reach eternity, that helps reach infinity. Again, words that are also very, very important for Blake, that we know imminently, though, not just, as it were, above and beyond, but also profoundly within. That's part of the perception of the mystics that Blake is part of as well.
Yeah, that's beautiful. And I see also how Blake is very much also coming from that mystical exploration or insight that there is, that all what is, I mean, everything we also named now in our conversation, there is a source to that, however we might call that, and that there is a way to also in ourselves to see that we are not just kind of randomly moved into that world or on that in that existence, but however we that this life is given by something on or by someone or however you call it, source of life, that all life is given from that. It's hard words now, but I think that's also why poetry is so important to communicate, or art. But I feel what you're pointing to, there is a way that this gives our lives a whole different ground and source of meaning, to see that we are actually participating in a bigger process of something, source of this, you know, cosmos to manifest itself. And however we find that, you know, also with the scientific discoveries, but also this kind of mystical insights, that there is a way to in ourselves and together, come to the awareness of that source, and that can give us a whole different way also how to perceive the world, but also how to be with the world, with, you know, with each other as human beings, but also with the more than human world. And yeah, I just feel this deeper mystical insight gives it a deep grounding to really see reality in a different way.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I mean, I appreciate that talk of God and religion and so on, Christianity, can be very off-putting for people. I think part of what's also going on in our times is a kind of spiritual quest that has become very suspicious, certainly in northern Protestant countries, certainly Christianity. But I feel that some sort of engagement with theism is very important. Otherwise, you just get kind of a replication of the spiritual in sort of consumer forms. You know, you go for this workshop or you're into that practice or whatever, and it can be useful and illuminating to a degree, but again, it doesn't really act that it might sustain you over the whole life course. So I feel that maybe we've had a generation or two of suspicion without, I'm not saying that everybody, as it were, needs to return to the old ways. It's not a reactive, nostalgic message, but maybe returning to the source, discovering the theistic, discovering the Neoplatonic, and discovering that impulse through these more mystical practices. I feel that is important. And Blake can help us with that. You know, Blake writes, "I'm not a god afar off. I'm a brother and a friend. I dwell in you and you dwell in me, mutual in love divine." And he'll say, "There's a moment in every day that Satan cannot find, nor can his watch fiends find it. But the industrious find this moment and it multiply. And when it once is found, it renovates every moment of the day, if rightly placed." There are these kind of free voices that can help us with this task.
Yeah, that's beautiful, because it's also not, like you are saying, and also in these words of Blake, it's not about believing in some new kind of, you know, image of God, or I don't know, idea, or even ideology or something, but it's more invite. It's what I hear also from Blake and what I saw and read of him. And others like him, it's an invitation to explore these realms in oneself and together with others in conversation and in conversation with the living world, to somehow rediscover that we are not, that we are actually always in that relationship, and that there's something there to meet us, and that in this relationship life can really have that kind of glow or that kind of spark, like you said, or that is in this phrases, when you see, you know, the you know, something in a grain of sand, in a tree, in the sun, something more than just the physical form, but that there is something. I feel that's for me also a promise of this, of someone like Blake, to show your life can really be enriched by that kind of richness of relationship and of conversation with, you know, with the world.
Yeah, look, I think this is all good. And so pursuing these conversations, whether it's in dialogues, listening to dialogues, reading books, you know, even going to an art gallery, it can be pursued. You know, it's not a great mystery how to pursue the mystical.
Mm-hmm. And maybe a last question. You called your book about William Blake Awake, like a call. Why did you choose this title? How do you see this awakening or this call that is coming from Blake, or how you sense that?
Yeah, I mean, it's a Blakean word. Blake often talks about awake, O sleeper in the land of shadows. He is, in his poetry, he said his poetry is a kind of product of himself feeling the call of the divine. He also, though, was a figure who saw angelic presences and other spirits and so on quite naturally and spontaneously. And of course, also saw how others around him didn't see these things quite so clearly. They maybe had felt impressions and so on, but to them, I think they looked like they were a bit asleep. So awake was a kind of call that he was making to his fellow human beings. But of course, it has a spiritual resonance, awakening, enlightening, you know, and Blake knew of traditions. It's perhaps not such a natural world in Christianity, but certainly in the traditions that come from India, which Blake knew. He read particularly the Bhagavad Gita and other Indian texts. That sort of sense of awakening is part of that tradition too. And when we're talking about light, for example, you know, you think you see the physical light and you've seen it all, but no, then you awaken to the inner light and then you awaken to the source of the light. That reaches back to Plato. It's quite a natural kind of word to use for the Platonic process. And I wanted the book, you know, not just to be a sort of history of Blake, not just to be an unpacking of his ideas, but to be a kind of call to be written in the spirit of Blake, so that people felt they were meeting Blake, not just as a artist, not just as an historic figure, but as someone, a prophet, as Blake said of himself, someone who was calling to them directly. And so setting that up on the front cover with this word awake seemed a way of doing that too.
Yeah, great. Thank you, Mark. Thank you very much for that conversation.
Well, look, thank you. And thanks for all that you do, because it's clearly part of this as well, fostering this imaginative approach through dialogue. So thank you too, Mike.
Yeah, thank you very much. Bye-bye.